is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. In Kentucky alone, heroin overdose deaths increased by 550% between 2011 and 2012. Police officers are getting more and more calls related to heroin, and new, tougher laws are being considered for heroin trafficking. The community is also getting involved as more and more families have friends affected by the drug. This afternoon, we're going to talk about how the community is reacting to the heroin problem. Joining me are Northern Kentucky Health Department District Director of Health, Dr. Lynn Sadler, Senior Program Officer Ann Barnum with Interact for Health, and with the Christ Hospital Physicians, Dr. Mike Kalfas. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Let's talk about, Dr. Sadler, we'll start with you. How big is the heroin problem? We talk about it's increased, but is it, it's increased from 5 to 10 necessarily, not that few, but how big is it really?
Heroin in this area has really, it not only is it large, but it continues to grow, and it will continue to grow until we're able to effectively work together to reduce the problem. You know, when we look on the Kentucky side of the river, and Ohio isn't altogether that different, we're looking at our overdose deaths have doubled from 2010 to 2012, from 31 to 61. We're seeing many more babies who are treated for drug withdrawal. Our overdoses at the hospitals have increased substantially. And in public health, of course, we're looking at diseases, infectious diseases like hepatitis C, and those have just exponentially increased. And those are just some of the health data that we're seeing. When you look at the law enforcement side of things, they're seeing many more arrests. They're seizing much more heroin. Anyone's data you look at indicates that we have a large and growing problem.
Anne, what are you seeing?
We are seeing the same things. Here, we looked at, for the Interact region, which is 20 counties, it's around Cincinnati. In 2011, we had 500 deaths related to heroin and other opiates. And that means one person every 17 hours died in our region. That's the most recent death data that we have. And we are the infection rates, particularly among young people, have increased. In these infections, like Dr. Sadler said, in hepatitis C, HIV, and endocarditis, a lining of the heart infection, and these have doubled and tripled over the past 5 years. So it's really become a huge thing that we are seeing. Partially, there are lots of reasons for this, I think.
Well, Dr. Kalfas, why don't you give us your take? What are you seeing?
Well, you know, I started working in addiction medicine back in 1996. I was medical director of the Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center down in Falmouth, Kentucky. And, you know, as far back as 1996, we saw maybe one heroin patient, maybe two a month coming into treatment. It just wasn't, you know, just talking, I'm speaking to how fast the epidemic's just blown out of proportion. So in a 15-year period from 96 to 2011, you're seeing this kind of numbers. So I think that speaks for itself as how quick this is growing. It's just really like a wildfire taking off.
I'm sorry. Let me just say that the treatment providers that we're involved with at Interact for Health have been saying for several years that they are seeing more people, and I asked them to quantify that. 6 or 7 years ago, maybe 2 to 3% of their population was heroin or opiate addicts. Now it's 80% of the patients in addictions treatment programs are heroin, predominantly heroin.
My observations were close to that. I think the 7 or 8 years ago, I probably saw a little higher percentage of heroin in Northern Kentucky, but I was in a rural and suburban area practicing, and just at that time, there was a real. It became kind of a novelty amongst teens and young adults in the suburban areas over Northern Kentucky. The latchkey kid kind of mentality, you know, they get home from school at 3 o'clock, their parents aren't home till 5 or 6. It's families that have incomes that could support a $20 to $40 a day habit. And it started circulating in that group of kids really the 7 or 8 years ago that you're talking about, Ann. And I saw a pretty high percentage of people at that point, and it's just taken off. I mean, it's just become cumbersome.
But it seemed like that it was such a drug of the 60s and 70s and then kind of went away. Why heroin coming back? Is it just because it's cheap?
I think everybody fell in love with cocaine in the 70s is part of what happened there. And cocaine, as it got expensive and fell out of vogue. Heroin was always something you had to shoot, and that wasn't, at least initially, having to inject it intravenously. That's not attractive to a lot of people. But I think a lot of people fall into the trap because the drug that's on the street now is the purity's there, the potency of the drug is there. So you can start off snorting the drug without having to inject it. And then as your tolerance develops, of course, most people do eventually progress to where they have to IV inject the drug, but for many people that comes later. So I think people saw it as somewhat innocuous, that it's not as dangerous as it used to be because you can snort it and you don't have to shoot it. And
but is that true?
No, it's absolutely not. I've known plenty of people, unfortunately, that have overdosed snorting it. So I mean, you can overdose if you get enough of it. If you snort enough of it, you can overdose. Whether it doesn't matter how you got it in, it matters whether you get enough of the drug in your system to stop breathing. That's what causes an overdose.
You know, when we came together as the Northern Kentucky Heroin Impact Response in looking at, well, how did we get to where we are so that we can better understand what we need to do to address this problem, there are a number of factors that seem to all come together at the same time. And I know Ann will talk about some of these as well. But having, as Mike said, heroin become readily available and inexpensive, combined with things like changes in laws that impacted people's ability to get access to prescription painkillers. And people who had were addicted to prescription painkillers who no longer could get them turned to something else that was readily available and inexpensive, being heroin. And there's other thoughts about, you know, what other factors could have contributed to this.
Are you saying then if people that can't get the prescription pain medicine are turning to this, that there will always be drug addicts among us? I mean, is it always, there's always going to be this underlying whatever percentage of people that are going to take some sort of drug, and heroin's available now, so it's heroin as opposed to something else? Or is it that heroin is so much more addictive that it's become a bigger problem?
I think there have always been people who abuse substances among us. I mean, this has been, it's been there since biblical times, even before.
Right.
So we can go to stories way back. And it doesn't, this is a problem because death is so rapid in relation to these
Absolutely.
Drugs. Absolutely. You know, we see this, and we see young people who are dying, not like someone who has been abusing alcohol, say, for many, many years, and their system just breaks down, but someone who may be trying to get clean and sober and then has a relapse, which is part of what happens with this disease, and they use the same amount they had, say, 30 days ago, and that amount kills them now.
Because they're no longer used to it. The tolerance isn't
there. The tolerance isn't there.
And Anne brings up a very good point, too, in that, you know, the traditional mindset when you're treating someone with an addiction, you know, it's based off the model of treating an alcoholic. And when a counselor is evaluating a patient to see where they are mentally, whether they're ready to progress into treatment or not, what you really want to see them is reach something called the contemplative phase, where and that's the phase where the person is just completely sick and tired of using the substance. They want this out of their life. They want to be done. A lot of people come into treatment in the pre-contemplative stage, and in other words, their major goal is to avoid the consequences. But, you know, in their heart of hearts, they want to be able to use and not have consequences. The difference is with an alcoholic, most of the time the attitude was, well, they'll come in, they'll be pre-contemplative. Eventually they'll progress to contemplative. They'll get there. You know, when they hit rock bottom enough, they'll be ready to get help. They'll be ready to come around. The problem with heroin is the physical disease progresses faster than the psychological part does. In other words, if we wait till the heroin addicted person becomes ready for treatment, hit rock bottom, they've usually overdosed before then. They're dead. So we've had to really rethink how we even treat people with this addiction compared to other addictions because the traditional models are inadequate. You know, the old idea was, well, you know, you just have to let them go. They'll have to come in when they want to come in. Unfortunately, they die while they're waiting. So,
Dr. Sada?
Yes, you had talked about, you know, have addictions always been with us? Will they always be with us? And if it's not heroin, will it be something else? And, you know, I go back to looking at it from the addressing any kind of issue like this from both prevention, can we prevent people from starting, and then also making sure there's adequate treatment available so that folks who are predisposed to addictions, who become addicted, can access treatment services quickly and not only go through treatment but have those recovery support services in place to help prevent the relapses.
You know, that's exact. I was going to really jump in on that. That it's yes, we've seen these always, but we have had some success in preventing people from starting to use drugs, whether those drugs be alcohol, tobacco, or other drugs, other substances. And there is everybody has a role to play in some of that prevention work. And we also have to look at what we do if someone does start. What do we do to stop the harm that might be caused by someone using over time? So stopping the infections, stopping the harm that comes to may come to a child if their mom is using while the child's in utero. So those are the kinds of things that you have to think about when you're thinking about a comprehensive plan like we did in Northern Kentucky.
I do want to talk about prevention. We're going to take a short break. When we continue our discussion, we will talk about what you can do to help prevent people from starting using the drugs. We're talking about heroin today. You can call us at 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking this afternoon about heroin abuse and the community reaction to attacking the problem. Joining me are Northern Kentucky Health Department District Director of Health, Dr. Lynn Sadler, Senior Program Officer Ann Barnum with Interact for Health, and with the Christ Hospital Physicians, Dr. Mike Kalfas. You can call us 513-419-7100 or email us, talk@wvxu.org. You can also post your questions on Facebook and Twitter. We're going to talk in just a moment about ways to help prevent people from starting drugs. But Dr. Kalfas, you wanted to weigh in on the whole discussion of addictions and will they always be here with us?
Yeah. Right before the break, you know, we were talking about, you know, the question that was posed was, have addictions or is the concept of people wanting to abuse a drug or use a substance always been with us? And I think, you know, something I've thought a lot about over the years, treating addicted patients, and just one of the things that really strikes me is that it's really a sickness that all of society kind of perpetuates. In other words, people that have holes in their lives in whatever area are more prone. I'm not saying that everybody that becomes addicted to something has a hole in their life, but the more holes in your life as far as just your human experience, the more holes you have, the more you look for relief. And, you know, I think as you see things, you know, the degradation of the family unit, you know, economic misfortune, those kinds of things, they make people more likely to progress into an addiction of some sort. I think the tendency has always been with us. It's part of our human nature to sort of control. We want to control our own destiny. We want to control every aspect of our lives. And sometimes it's controlling a mood with using a substance. It's controlling a thought. It's controlling whatever part of our environment. But if we can find an external way to do that, a chemical often becomes that control button. People are more likely to abuse that, I think, when there's just more and more problems in society. And I think as a society deteriorates, you'll see more issues with that. And I think if you look at the last 20 years in our culture, there's just been a lot of issues that have reached social prominence. And I think that it all contributes. And all this just underscores the fact that it's not just one person's problem or one group of people's problems. It's a societal problem. That's the point I wanted to make. That we all bear the burden. If there's something that affects children and teenagers, we all have to be noticing, what's going on with them. And we can't just isolate ourselves in a society.
Let's talk a little bit about ways to prevent that. And with all that is going on, and that being part of the problem as well, what are you recommending? And Dr. Sadler, maybe you can start. What are you recommending in terms of what the general public can do to help prevent the problem?
Well, to me, it all starts with all of us need to sort of examine our thoughts about addiction and mental illness, and whether or not how we have viewed these things in a way that's been helpful to solving the problem. Because I really think that everything stems from our thoughts and our beliefs about addiction, and whether or not we see addiction as a chronic disease of the brain that needs and deserves medical treatment, much the way that other chronic diseases like diabetes, asthma, hypertension, and how we view those and how we treat those. And so to me, that's where it all starts. But more concrete kinds of things in terms of prevention, we are involved and have a small grant program working on trying to help youth not start using prescription drugs, taking them from, the medicine cabinet at home or at grandma's house or whatever, because we know that oftentimes that's sort of the gateway to heroin, is to start with the prescription painkillers. And so we encourage folks, if you have some of these old bottles from old injuries, you were prescribed these medications and you're done with them, to dispose of them safely. There are drop boxes at police departments where you can dispose of them. Get them out of your house so that they're not a temptation to anyone.
And please don't flush them down the toilet. Right?
Exactly. The proper disposal. So that's some of the ways. But also looking at what can be done to, as Dr. Kalfa said, how do we help families and give families the resources that they need to know what's going on in their family, and to look at signs and symptoms, and look at if they have holes in their family life, and what can be done to fill those with positive, constructive things and build up the family.
I want to go to the phone calls now. Brian is calling in from Green Hills. Hi, Brian. What's your comment?
My comment is I'm totally straight now. I've been a born again Christian for about 5 years. I think I know personally that drug addiction. I used to shoot up heroin and all that stuff, coke and Dilata and all that stuff. And I was an alcoholic, stone alcoholic, still functioning alcoholic though. And I know for sure that it's a spiritual problem. That drugs and alcohol are a spiritual problem. And if people would turn to the Lord, Jesus Christ, Yeshua in the Hebrew, and if they would start getting the Bible and they would start reading, just start in John and just read it through, and pray, if they're really serious about getting off drugs, there's the answer right there.
That was your biggest help then, was when you just saw it as a spiritual situation. We appreciate that, Brian. Thanks so much for your call. If you'd like to offer a question or a comment, the number is 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org.
And Brian, I just want to tell you congratulations. I think that's wonderful.
Absolutely.
And there are so many, there are many paths to recovery from addiction. And you have been able to find and hold on to that spiritual path to recovery, which is excellent. Some folks find other mechanisms. The support of a supportive recovery community does it for some. We were talking about prevention earlier, and I just want to say that one of the things that anyone can do is to have the conversation with young people in your life, older people in your life, anyone who is maybe having struggles. But to have the conversation about drugs, it's not okay. Parents making sure that kids know their impressions, and it's never too early to start having that kind of conversation with your kids. And for those of us who don't have children, knowing the names of the kids on your block is actually preventive.
Mm-hmm.
If you can know the names of the kids that come by your front door every day and you can say hello to them and ask them how their day's going, that shows them that they're valuable and makes it less likely that they will pick up drugs in a non-productive way.
I want to go now to John in Sharonville. Hi, John. What's your question?
In regards to heroin, you guys talked about the stages pre-contemplation and contemplation. And I was wondering, in regards to pharmaceuticals or the other class of opiates, do those stages apply, or they just apply just to heroin?
Basically, those are the stages of addiction. Okay, so those terms are sort of descriptive as where someone is within the disease of their addiction, what stage they're in. The progression from one stage to the next, whether you're pre-contemplative or contemplative, a lot of times that's going to depend on the individual and on the drug. And I think the point I was trying to make is, hopefully, most people that are addicted to something will make it to the contemplative stage because that's really where they're the easiest to help and to help them get better. The point I was trying to make is with heroin, it progresses so fast that many people die before they get to the contemplative stage. But that applies to pills, that applies to alcohol, that applies to all that. It's the heroin.
Okay, so like the pharmaceutical, the pain industry, would that apply to that? You know, people that are hooked on pain pills, would that fall in the same categorization?
Absolutely. And now I would like to make a distinction, though, when we're talking about pain medication. There's a difference between physical dependency and addiction. Sometimes it's a very fine line. It's a very difficult thing to maneuver. These pills would not be allowed to continue to exist if they didn't have an appropriate medical usage. The term dependence, physical dependence, implies that there's two things at play. First is tolerance. It takes more to get the same effect. And secondly, it implies that there's a withdrawal syndrome of some type. So if they stopped using the drug abruptly, they will go into some kind of uncomfortable, either physical or psychological withdrawal or both. Now, it's not necessarily a disease state for someone to be physically dependent on opiates. I've met people that have had 5 and 6 back surgeries, people that have cancer pain, people that have conditions where they are fully capable of taking the 3 or 4 pain pills a day that their doctor prescribes them. They don't abuse them. They don't run out early. They take them. If they stop taking those medications, they will go into withdrawal. That person is not an addict. Addiction implies that there's something beyond the physical dependency. There's an out-of-control nature to it. There's continued use in spite of negative consequences. You've got every reason in the world to stop it, but you don't. You can't. It's out of your control. And that's really the difference between dependency and addiction. Addiction is really a control issue. You're out of control with it.
John, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. If you have a question or a comment, 513-419-7100. We've been talking about prevention, and you were talking just about saying hello to a kid on the street or a child in your neighborhood. What are some other things that people can do to not only help their own kids, but just to help their friends, people they know, or if they think there could be a problem, what should they do?
my personal take on it is, you know, I appreciated Brian's call because I'm big on the spirituality side of it. I feel that that's an important part of recovery. And any of my patients will tell you there's always a sermon involved so when they come into my office. So
we're going to go now to Michelle, who is calling in. I just moved here from Boston. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine. What's your question or comment?
I just recently moved here from Boston, and I was working in substance abuse prevention, and they have a program in the city of Boston where they train family members, addicts, service providers to administer Narcan. And I was wondering if there are any programs like that in the Cincinnati area and Northern Kentucky.
And tell us what Narcan is and what your take on it is.
Narcan is a drug also known as naloxone, and it is an overdose reversal drug. It is given to someone if they have overdosed, and it immediately puts them into withdrawal. The good news is they're still alive. The bad news is for them, they're pretty uncomfortable at that point. But they are alive. You need to stay with them and make sure that they stay alive until emergency medical folks come. There is naloxone distribution going on here in our community. There is a program that the Center for Chemical Addictions Treatment runs out of their facility for their patients to whom they give a naloxone kit when they are leaving, if the patients agree to and want to take that with them. The other program that's currently happening is happening in Northern Kentucky in Falmouth, and the heroin response impact group, which, the name of which I never get right, is making that happen through People Advocating Recovery and Dr. Jeremy Engel and his efforts there. I think Dr. Kalfas is also involved in that.
Not as much as I'd like to be, but
So we are distributing there. We also have just received here in Cincinnati through the efforts of Dr. Judith Feinberg, a grant from the Ohio Department of Health to distribute naloxone in Hamilton County. So, yes, there are efforts that are going on, but they are not nearly as large as the one in Boston. So
I assume, Michelle, that you found that to be a helpful program there?
Yeah, it was really a lot of I actually got trained right before I moved, and a lot of the addicts in the room were saying it was helpful for them. Either someone had used it on them or they had used it on a friend.
Michelle, make sure you contact one of us after this, because we would love to have a trained volunteer engaged in our efforts.
Great.
Thank you, Michelle. We appreciate the call.
Thank you.
We're talking this afternoon about heroin and the problems it is causing in the community, and we will continue our discussion in just a moment. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us, talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking about heroin and the many problems it causes, not only for families directly involved, but the entire community. My guests are Northern Kentucky Health Department District Director of Health, Dr. Lynn Sadler, Senior Program Officer Ann Barnum with the Interact for Health, and with the Christ Hospital Physicians, Dr. Mike Kalfas. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or email us, talk@wvxu.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. We go now to Brandon, who's calling in from Kenwood. Hi, Brandon.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's your comment?
I was listening to the show because I'm actually driving right now. But I'm a recovering heroin addict. I've been clean for 8.5 years. I got clean in San Francisco. I was out there living on the streets due to the heroin addiction. But the key out there, and what was a big help, was the harm reduction out there, along with the needle exchange. And, you know, I did work with the needle exchange. We provided the Narcan training. And I think that's something that, you know, the Cincinnati area is lacking. You know, it's just, it's sad. But how I did it was, you know, I'm involved with the 12-step, you know, community. So that was how I did it. But I agree with what was being said earlier is, you know, I had to come to that point where I was no longer, it was no longer an option for me. and I had to make a choice. I wasn't available to make the choice in the beginning of my addiction, but I finally came to the place, and only then was recovery possible.
Anne, you had a comment.
Yeah, I just congratulations, first off. But secondly, we are right at the very beginning of starting a syringe exchange project here in the greater Cincinnati area. Interact for Health has awarded a grant to the University of Cincinnati, predominantly through the efforts of Dr. Judith Feinberg, to do a syringe exchange, which is going to be located in a mobile van so that it can move about in various places. It's going to start in the city of Springdale, hopefully by the 1st of February. So if you're interested in helping out with that, we'd be glad to hear from you.
Well, I have a question. With the whole needle exchange issue, and you do that, of course, so they're not reinfecting using used needles and those sorts of things. But how does that in the long run help with kicking the problem? Dr. Sadler?
Well, there's a couple of things I wanted to say about it. And to answer your specific question, whenever someone with an addiction comes into contact with healthcare providers, counselors, whoever's operating the program, it gives them a chance to see where are they at in terms of contemplating a change in their lives and making resources available as part of that contact or interaction. And so studies have shown that these types of programs do help people get into treatment. So it actually helps be a bridge and connect them to and help them move along that continuum quicker.
So it's really more than just about getting a clean needle.
It really is, because it's usually combined with other services like testing for hepatitis C and HIV, educating and counseling them about their risks, and talking about moving, getting into treatment, and connecting them with other services, medical and social service types of services that they may need.
Dr. Goff.
You know, I was just going to weigh in there too. You have to go back to even more of a basic question. Why do we care about drug use? Why do we care about addiction? Because there are consequences to that. There's consequences to using a drug. There's consequences to addiction. And from society's point, as well as the people afflicted with the addiction, one of the biggest complications are these diseases, are Hep C and HIV, and we need to stop the diseases. We don't just simply – you're not going to just fix the problem by just going and turning the heroin pipeline off. That's not possible. So you have to start with the people that are afflicted, and you have to minimize their risk, minimize the diseases that they're exposed to, so then we can continue to concentrate our efforts to getting – to treating the addiction itself. Like Dr. Sadler said, you know, once they're in your sight, so to speak, then you can start getting them into other forms of treatment. So that's a great entry port. But I mean, that's an important consequence of addiction. If you look at, for example, Eastern Europe, where they have a heroin epidemic that's ahead of ours by quite a bit, you know, the numbers on, you know, Hep C dependent or Hep C positivity are 60% among the IV drug users. HIV is 90%+ in those folks. And so do we want those problems to deal with on top of the addiction problem? Of course not. So our efforts have to be global. We have to attack every aspect of this epidemic in our society. And part of that epidemic is that the diseases that go with it.
Brandon, thanks so much for your call. I'm going to go now to Giles in College Hill. Hi, Giles.
Hi. I was just wondering, are there any services available in Cincinnati for people who are trying to kick heroin addiction medically who don't have health insurance?
Yes.
Can you tell us what they are?
Yes. Yes. There are a number of public providers in this area. And if you're speaking about on the Ohio side of the river and Hamilton County specifically, the Mental Health and Recovery Services Board can certainly give you a list of those providers. They include Talbert House, CCAT, First Step Home, if it's a woman, Crossroads, and a variety of others that are there and available for people who do not have insurance coverage. The good news is, though, that insurance is now covering more because of the Affordable Care Act and the demand for parity within that law.
And we should let you know that we do have a number of links on our website to some of the places that were discussed here, and you can find those at WVXU.org. Go to the Cincinnati Edition page. Giles, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Sadler, you were going to add something there?
I did. Back on the harm reduction discussion, you know, this is a great thing for people with heroin addiction, and as far as studies showing that it dramatically reduces the infection rates for hepatitis C and HIV when you've got needle exchange programs. But just as important is the public safety piece. If you can get used needles out of the community, out of parks and parking lots and the streets, you know, it protects the public. It protects
law enforcement.
It protects first responders. You know, and that's another, I think, really important piece for the community to know. And then the other piece being right now in Kentucky, the laws prohibit needle exchange or syringe exchange programs.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100. Cindy's calling from Dayton. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine. What's your question?
I have a daughter who's been struggling with heroin addiction for several years. She's been back and forth in going to programs and to a methadone clinic for a while. Currently, she's been on Suboxone for about a year. And I was just wondering what your feelings were on Suboxone and how long someone should stay on that, if they should taper off.
Dr. Kalfas?
That's a great question. I run into it a lot myself. You know, when we look at different medications and different treatments, those are tools. And we have to use tools in the appropriate manner when we use them. And for one patient, it may be use this tool. For another patient, you may use a different tool. What Suboxone does is it helps to balance the brain chemistry without giving someone the high that they normally experience with an opiate. That is invaluable in the sense that this person can work on putting their life back together. They can take the steps that they need to heal. They can progress from that pre-contemplative stage to that contemplative stage and stay alive while they're doing it. So I know I'm getting to the answer to your question, and that is, you know, first of all, do I believe in it? Absolutely. Is it for everyone? No, but it's good for a lot of people if we have more access to it. How long should you stay on it? That's going to be patient dependent. My very first patient that I put on it in 2003 is still on it. But – and some people would want to argue with me that that's a failure. No, it isn't. He's a good father. He's a loyal husband. He works every day. He comes in every month and gets his prescription. He's not high. He's not impaired by the drug. He functions completely normally. And now that he's been ready over the last year or two, we've been reducing his dose and he's working to getting off of it. I've had patients that get off of it in 6 months. They're at the right place in their recovery that they're ready to get off of it. So my opinion on Suboxone is that it needs to be patient-specific, patient-directed based on what they need. I know there are different models out there on how different people use Suboxone. Some have strict guidelines. You come in 3 months, you wean off of it 3 months, and or whatever the protocols are. Everybody has a different opinion. My opinion is that it's patient-specific, and it should address where that patient is in recovery. And if they're on it, I don't have a problem with someone staying on it indefinitely as long as they're safe and they're alive and they're not impaired and they're living a good life. And
Cindy, does that answer your question?
It does. That helps a lot. She also sees a psychiatrist who's been giving her Ambien and Adderall. Is that contradictory to trying to use a Suboxone?
I don't know that I'd use the words contradictory, but I would say you have to be very careful. And obviously by the fact she's seeing a psychiatrist, that does imply that, at least hopefully, that there's a great deal of caution. The class of drugs called benzodiazepines, which include Valium and Xanax and Klonopin, those kinds of medications, that you have to be extremely careful with Suboxone with those medications. And while they are used, you just have to be careful. Ambien is similar to Valium, so you have to be very careful with it. Those are treating other conditions, and if you don't treat those other conditions, sometimes that makes it harder for the person to recover. So I would say it's not necessarily inappropriate, but it does raise the warning flag of proceed very carefully here.
Cindy, thanks so much for your call. We go now to Ann in Falmouth. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
What's your question?
My son had an addiction to heroin and OxyContin, and Dr. Kalfas was a major contributor in trying to get him off of these drugs. But I just want to say that it is one of the most important things is to make sure that these young people, these fathers and children and mothers, it's majorly important that they do not go back to the same friends that they had previously.
Do you all agree with that you have to sort of separate yourself from the people?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
When I meet with a patient, I always try to give them – I mean, I'm a fan of 12-step programs, and I always, you know, try to get them to attend those a couple times a week. But I always have kind of Kalfas's three rules, you know, that I give them and when I meet with somebody. And to simplify it, I say number one is you change what needs to be changed, people, places, and things. That's part of the pathology of your disease is you've gotten into unhealthy patterns, unhealthy connections, and those need to be redone, need to be rewired. Secondly, you take care of yourself physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. You've got to deal with your issues, insomnia, depression, you know, spirituality, whatever. Those are all important. They need to be addressed. And then the third one I give them is don't open the cage door. And I kind of paint the scenario. It's like you're taking a monster and you're putting it in a cage. And it yells and screams and beats the bars and roars. But then like a child with a temper tantrum, it gets tired and it quits and it lays down and it kind of goes to sleep. And you're tempted to look at it like, oh, that's not as scary anymore. I miss my old friend. Oh, he's kind of even cute. And maybe I'll just open the door and play with him a little bit. And that's when he bites you. And I just say, just as a general rule, anytime there's a temptation, remind yourself, don't open the cage door. So that's just the advice I give to patients on a routine basis. But yeah, I think that's a huge part of it is it's not just putting the drug in your body that's causing the disease. It's a constellation of symptoms. It's maladaptive coping skills. It's bad connections. It's whatever. But you've got to break those and restructure your life. That's what the 12 steps are. They're a stepwise approach. It's the instructions, if you will, to putting your life back together.
Ann, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. Our number is 513-419-7100. Any other comments that you wanted to make related to that? They're good. All right, we're going to go now to Amanda in Liberty Township. Hi, Amanda. Amanda?
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I was calling because as a teenager, I did smoke marijuana, and I eventually wound up hanging out with heroin users and crack smokers. And just seeing that, despite any curiosity I may have had, wiped out any desire to do those drugs ever because they're just, it's unpleasant and unattractive. I was wondering if they have any programs in place where kids who are at risk for using drugs, heart drugs, if they can, you know, go and witness that for themselves, because I think it would eradicate any, you know, longing to try heroin or, you know, other harder drugs.
That sounds a little complicated to do. Anne, what do you?
Yeah, I would say that I'm glad that helped you to move forward, but research shows that those kinds of activities do not usually assist people in not using, that showing them that effort is not always helpful in that. The whole scared straight attitude is not always as helpful. It's usually more helpful to get folks involved in pro-social activities, activities in their church or their school or with their families, having family dinners and talking about the preventive aspects of just those kinds of relationships. That's why it's really important that people talk to their kids about what's going on.
Absolutely.
And get rid of the drugs in the household.
Yes.
You know, making sure that we do that. And most of our – we have most of the police stations in northern Kentucky have drop boxes in them. Some of the police stations in the greater Cincinnati, the rest of the greater Cincinnati area have that. In Indiana, they have it. So I know we've got listeners from all over.
Thanks so much for your call, Amanda. We appreciate it. We did get an email from Robin, who's a hospital nurse, and she was wondering about methadone clinics that keep patients on methadones for years. Is that wrong? And Dr. Calvis, maybe you can relate that to what
you're
speaking
actually,
about
earlier. That really is another great question, because it follows on the heels of what we were talking about with Suboxone. And I'll when we do our town hall meetings with our Northern Kentucky Impact Committee, one of the thing and with people advocating recovery, we do a lot of these town hall meetings, and I have a whole spiel that I go into, but I won't go into it for the sake of time. But in a nutshell, when I mentioned tools with Suboxone, methadone is another tool. Methadone was probably the first tool that we had. The very first person to medically research heroin addiction. Dr. Rice came to the conclusion that heroin addiction is a chronic brain disease. It's incurable. Well, he's not completely right on that, but he did have some good points. But he advocated actually putting people on methadone for an indeterminate amount of time, forever. And while we know that some people can get off of it, methadone is not without risk. Methadone, you can overdose on it. Methadone can give you a high. It can make you intoxicated. It can – usually doesn't if it's used appropriately. Good, well-run methadone clinics save lives. Methadone probably isn't the first line of therapy for a addicted patient. But let's face it, if we love our kids, we love our families, we want that tool available to them. I would rather my son or daughter be on methadone than dead. And for many people, that is the difference. We need good, well-run clinics.
Ann, did you want?
Yeah, I certainly agree. And I think that we have not had enough availability of medication-assisted therapies, which both Suboxone and methadone mm-hmm. are. But it's medication-assisted therapies. You cannot do – you know, you can't just substitute the drug in and not have someone who is helping you progress along in a recovery mode. A counselor, a physician who cares, like Dr. Kalfas, you know, people who understand the progression of this chronic, sometimes fatal disease.
You got to be fixing the things that are broken while you're working on it. I mean, it's just simply taking a pill. That's a pre-contemplative way to do things. You've got to get contemplative. You got to want to fix stuff.
Well, time for one more call. Sabrina from Westchester. Hi, Sabrina. What's your question?
Hi. How are you today?
Just fine. What's your question?
I wanted to know if there are any physical signs where you can tell if someone is on heroin, and you answered my question before, if there was a place where you could send kids to for prevention programs.
Is there?
There are lots of prevention types of programs, most of which come through schools and other folks. So,
I would be suspicious if. Several things, and unfortunately are kind of vague and nonspecific findings. But when you see them all together, you should start asking questions. I would look at things like, first of all, mood and behavior changes. Someone who's normally outgoing that becomes withdrawn and secretive, complexion, dark circles under the eyes, weight loss. In a young adult, often they usually use weight when you're using drugs regularly. Oftentimes, you don't eat, you lose weight. Needle tracks in the arm, bruises.
Thank you. We are out of time. We could go on for a long time, and I'm sure we'll be talking about this again, and I don't think it's going to be fixed in the next few weeks. So we appreciate all of your conversations today. Thank you for joining us. We've been talking about heroin abuse in Greater Cincinnati. My guests have been Northern Kentucky Health Department District Director of Health, Dr. Lynn Sadler, Senior Program Officer Ann Barnum with Interact for Health, and with the Christ Hospital Physicians, Dr. Mike Kalfas. Cincinnati Edition is produced by Pete Reitmeier. Today's technical director was Rick Andres. Our engineering staff is Don Danko, Bill Dean, and Mike Makinich. We also had help today from Kevin Reynolds. Archives of our program are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Marianne Zalesnik.